guided partly by your little autobiographical memoir in the anthropology, the annual review of anthropology, to ask you a few questions.
Yes, fine.
I mean, let's start off, if you like, with a bit of autobiography. No doubt, we're not sufficiently postmodern to think that anthropology is essentially an autobiographical genre.
Exactly.
But nevertheless, it might help the background. Now, you do compare your background with Maya Fortes and Edmund Leach's. You just say it was more modest in the home counties. Could you perhaps elaborate a bit more about where you came from, who your parents were, where you went to school, that sort of stuff?
Yes, I went to... my parents were... My father was a Londoner. And my mother was from the borders of Aberdeenshire and Bampshire. But she met my father in London. And they, after the war, after the First World War, they moved out to Welwyn Garden City. So I first of all grew up in Welwyn Garden City and went to primary school there, and then went off later on to, there was no secondary school in Welwyn Garden City at the time, so I went to school at St Albans, travelled there by train every day. And then my parents eventually moved there, because my brother and I were going there, so they moved to Scotland, so we lived there afterwards, but that was where I went to school.
And your father, what sort of profession?
My father was, my father was worked in a, as an advertising manager in London, but he was a, his background was a, was as an electrician, really, an electrical engineer, I suppose, a technical, he became a technical journalist in the early days of electricity, and then went to worked in a, as an advertising manager later on for a firm in London, Bridge Thompson Houston.
And your mother was just at home, or was she...
My mother used to work in the Central Post Office in London, I mean in the Post Office Administration, like savings books and things like that, when she came down from Scotland. So she worked, but she didn't work later on. I mean, she didn't work after she was married. So she was at home, but my father went up to the city from wherever we were. So we lived in, in Hertfordshire, in, just on the outskirts of London.
Almost into Cambridge.
It wasn't very far from where I am now. It was just about halfway between Cambridge and... Indeed, I cycled up to Cambridge at one stage in the days when the roads were slightly less encumbered than they are now. I actually cycled from St Albans to here. But yes, it's my home country. It's East Anglia.
Let me move quickly to Cambridge, which it's like a logical connection. Could you say a little bit more about the intellectual atmosphere, your friends, your influences, in a sense, your impression of Cambridge when you came? Because obviously I observed that at least two or three of the people that you've collaborated with over your life are people that you must first have known in the days when we met.
Yes.
Namely, just before the war in Cambridge. People
that's,
like Ian Watt and Peter Lazard.
That's absolutely true. I, well, I read English when I came up, and I suppose at school I'd been much influenced by a schoolmaster who had worked with the Levis School. And a number of my friends, you know, got scholarships at Downing and, in that crowd. So partly it was the sort of ferment of the English school at that time, which, as I recall, was organising a lot of its own teaching or own seminars. And so indeed was the Socialist Club. I mean, that was also organising its own seminars.
Yes, I remember.
There, you remember. In fact, I remember going to one by Gilbert Phillips and various other people. There was a lot of sort of alternative activity going on. When I came up to university, I didn't really go to many lectures at all. I mean, there were so many other things to be done at that moment. But, you know, it was the middle of the, towards the end of the Spanish Civil War. And when I was much involved with political activity. And there were a series of events leading up to the war, which immediately took one into the political field. So a lot of one's activity is sort of centered on politics. So it was natural that one, you know, took seminars, as it were, in the Socialist Club on a variety of topics. But we also did the same in the English faculty. It was also organising its own seminars. I mean, there was a lot of sort of autonomous activity, I think, going on at that time. It seemed to be extremely lively in that way.
Faculty groups, I seem to remember.
They were faculty groups of one kind or another. But it was also, in the English faculty, it was the faculty as the English Students Association, whatever it's called, was organising various things. It was Boris Ford, who later edited the Penguin History of English Literature, and various other people who were very vigorous in that at the time. So I didn't go to many lectures in my first year.
Other than Leavis?
I went to Leavis' seminars
.
In Downing. I went to Leavis' seminars. I went to Hugh Sykes Davis' lectures because he was my supervisor. And I went to a number of other things, you know, but I mean, the very few was connected with what I was actually meant to be doing at the time. Indeed, at that particular time, you had to fill in a piece of paper at the beginning of term which told you, was then sent to your director of studies, I think, saying that you were attending this course of lectures and that. And I remember I got kind of reprimanded for not attending sufficient lectures at the time. But there seemed so much else to do. I mean, it was very lively. And a great intellectual atmosphere. And it also seemed very near the real world, I suppose, and partly because people were going off to Spain and being involved in the Spanish Civil War. So that one felt one was very close to what was happening outside Cambridge, as distinct from being a school.
Presumably, of course, the influence of Marx through the Socialist Club, Communist Party and so on, must also have been noticeable at that time, at least I
well, think very noticeable
in my case.
Very noticeable, but I mean, you know, while I read a certain amount of that literature, well, I was once still at school. I mean, I think I was a member of the Left Book Club at school, and so before I ever came up to Cambridge. And it was the time of Collins' publishing of the Left Book Club, which I suppose it was important to a whole lot of people because gave them access to cheap, inexpensive books before the paperback era. And so I read, you know, a good deal of the act and was interested in the works of Marx and Engels at the time. So that naturally led on to Socialist Club and left-wing politics and so on in Cambridge.
It's very interesting because, I mean, you know, obviously your case was by no means untypical. I mean, I myself was the pupil of one of these young English teachers.
Who, oh, really?
Yes, who come from Cambridge, Leavis. I put down Downing as one of my colleges for the thing.
So did I, but I didn't get into Downing, I should say. I would have loved to have got into Downing. That was the height of my ambition.
But you see, when I came up to Cambridge, I decided, well, maybe English wasn't the thing. Did you ever consider not studying English or studying something else?
I should have done. I was much better at history than I was at English, to tell you the truth. I mean, you know, my A-levels and all that kind of thing, and I should really have studied history and not English. But English was kind of the peak thing for so many of us at the time. I didn't realise you hadn't done English, but Edward Thompson, and so on. I mean, all these people. I mean, so many people did English at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the, it was, I know, years after the war. I mean, Ken Barrell told me that it was the most difficult subject to get into at university. I don't know if that remains true today, but it was many years. That is, you know, you require the highest A levels to get in there. I mean, it was the peak of so many of our efforts to get into it. Somehow I never had the drive to get into history that way. I mean, it was English literature that I wanted to do.
And in a sense, which of the people, either your friends, because obviously, as you say, a great deal of what one learned from one's contemporaries rather than from teachers, or the teachers, or in other ways, what were the sort of chief people that influenced you, if any, or whom do you think you influenced?
Well, I mean, you know, a lot of people at Cambridge, I mean, the people who were just sort of slightly senior than me. Mm. I mean, like Matthew Hodgett, Arnold Kettle, I mean, yourself and others. These, I suppose, were the significant ones. The people who were 2 or 3 years older and beginning to be research students. Ian Watt, with whom I worked later on. These kind of people. And the people who were giving the seminars. I mean, people like Boris Ford, a friend of mine, Raymond Winkler, was at the same school as I was.
Oh, he was at the same school as you?
Yes,
I remember.
He was a great influence on me at school. He read English at school. He got the scholarship to Downing, but I was...
R.O.C. Winkler.
Absolutely right. R.O.C. Winkler. That's a very good memory. R.O.C. Winkler, who died young, became a philosopher. And, yes, I mean, he was a great influence at school. But that was the, you know, it was just that those people were slightly older than you. I mean, I don't think that I ever went to, or certainly didn't listen to, anybody over about 30, probably in those days.
It's an interesting point. There's no question about it. And in our days, really, it was mutual education much more than education from top to bottom.
Yes,
I think most people would probably think
it's absolutely right. I mean, and that was the vigour of Cambridge to me when I came up at all levels. I mean, it is true there was Leavesy seminars, but it was that kind of that kind of group that was and those circles that you know that I feel I got my education from, and that's where I sort of talked about the books that I've read or the books that other people have read and so on. And ideas. It was in that kind of ambiance.
Did you have at that time any particular relationship with non-European students, third world students, as we would say today, colonial students, I think you would have said in those days?
Not in any very specific way. I mean, I knew you know, people in the marches and you know, people like Aviators and so on in the Socialist Club. But I didn't know of... I hadn't got any close ties with them, no. I didn't think, I mean... My first interest in a sense, or knowledge of anthropology, was not that way. I mean, it was through... it was not the way that these sons of tea planters came into the profession at all. I wasn't a son of a tea planter. It was through things like the notes in the Wasteland and the references to Fraser and this kind of thing. It was Leavesy's references to Lord Raglan and you know and that kind of. I mean, that's really where I first got to know the name from. Probably was that, not anything else. It was medieval drama. I mean, I think I said that when I was in prison camp in Germany later on, there was a very good library run by somebody who must have known at King's, Jim Mumby.
Oh, yes.
Jim was our librarian in prison camp in
Shalag 7b of Plural. And the library there, which I joined it later on, joined the camp later on, was one which had been accumulated by these people since Dunkirk, so it was really quite an extensive library. And that's where I read Fraser, at least two volumes of Fraser anyhow, at the time, and Chambers's Medieval Stage, which I'd always wanted to read, and some of that kind of thing. But it was more through that, really, than particularly an interest in overseas, than in people overseas. But once again, I mean, there was so much contact at the time, particularly with Indian students. But really, my own personal contact with Indian students really came after the war, or during the war and after the war, especially.
Well, this actually does get us to the war, doesn't it? Now, it seems to me that the war really had quite a big impact on you intellectually in many ways. Through your experiences in Italy and your reading and all the rest of it, in a way, what did it teach you? What ideas did you derive from it? What experiences? Can you say a little bit about
it? Yes. Well, very briefly, I was going to the Middle East for the first time and spending some time there in Cyprus. And it was walking into, being in Cyprus villages, in Cypriot villages, and seeing them use the Mediterranean plough, and then going into the museum in Cyprus and seeing the same kind of plough there used 4,000 years ago. It was this kind of thing that got me interested about. And that got me interested in reading things which I sort of vaguely started before, like getting more interested in the works of Gordon Child. So it was then, you know, being camped under the pyramids in Cairo, ready to take off the Western Desert, that kind of thing that got me interested in the ancient Middle East and in the kind of work that Child did, an aspect of archaeology. Well, I'd grown up in Stormans, and I do remember Sir Mortimer Wheeler unearthing the, at least I think I remember, Sir Mortimer Wheeler unearthing part of the Hypocaust in Viridarium, which has that magnificent Neptune mosaic on top, which is now the museum. So I grew up in that, and people were interested in archaeology at school. So I was interested. It was being in the Middle East and actually sort of seeing the remnants and being able to walk up into Disney-like Crusader castles and going into this Gothic cathedral in the middle of Nicosia, which was in fact taken over as a mosque, seeing it sort of transformed into a mosque. I mean, this is what sort of got me interested in the Middle East, I suppose, and cultures, and the cultures of the Middle East. But more specifically, as far as anthropology was concerned, yes, it was Italy, really, after I'd been taken captured, after being captured at Tobruk in 42, when we were taken to Italy. And there were two things there. Firstly, I was in a camp in Italy in which we had obviously little to do, since as an officer one wasn't expected to plough in the fields. So we arranged a lot of courses of one kind or another, and university courses and others, and I got involved, you know, in teaching modern English literature with a friend of mine called Stuart Hood, who wrote his memoirs of escaping in Italy later on, and eventually directed ITV, I think. I had a lot of time there. I played a great deal of bridge. At the end of the war, when I had only done 1 year of university and couldn't think who would employ me, I even thought of becoming a professional bridge player all the time. The only thing I could do, really, that qualified me for anything, as far as I can see. But I got very interested in It's all social interaction in small groups, as one inevitably did, sort of living with people in a confined space. And so that's one of the things, actually, that I got interested in later on. And secondly, it was when I escaped in Italy and spent some time up in the Rozzi in the hills with peasants. Well, living near with peasants up in the hills. And later on in Rome, when I was later on escaped again and was hiking out. So it was more Europe and the Middle East that interested me, I think, that aspect of things, more than Africa. I wasn't initially interested in Africa, where I'd spent relatively little time, but it was in Europe. I was interested in peasant agriculture and peasant way of life.
Well, that actually leads to the question, why then did you settle down to Africa?
Well, the economic base was not far away. I didn't settle down to Africa at all. What I did, first of all, was I finished, when I came back to Cambridge, I finished off a degree in English very quickly. And then did what I wanted to do, and that was took a year and did a diploma in anthropology.
Why in anthropology, which was not the most obvious choice at the time?
Well, if there'd been sociology, I might well have done sociology. But if sociology had been on the cards, I might well have done that. Except that sociology wouldn't have led me into peasant studies. Not that anthropology at the time led me into peasant studies either, because it was Evans Pritchard was lecturing here at the time, and that's very much Africa. It was partly Evans Pritchard, was a very influential lecturer, a very influential figure at that time, and he moved many people, I think, at Cambridge to take up anthropology. I didn't do so immediately. I went into education for a while. I felt I was sent around prisoner of war camps and things for long enough, and I wanted to do something active. So I was an education officer in Hertfordshire for a while, doing adult education. And then I saw what I would have liked to have done at that time was to go and work and do sociological work, I think. I mean, I was interested in the work with the Tavistock Clinic in London, partly because they had been interested in returning prisoners of war. And the way people adjusted when they came back into the community and that kind of problem. And I applied for a job at Dottington Hall, where they wanted somebody to do some research. I didn't get the job, quite rightly, because I hadn't got any qualifications. So it was then that I decided I need to get some more qualifications. And so then I decided to take a PhD in anthropology, mainly because, I mean, partly because it was being funded from government funds. I mean, that was one way of doing it. They were offering scholarships for this kind of thing. And I applied for a scholarship with the only social science research council that was in England at the time. Typically, which was a Clarion Social Science Research Council. I knew a lot of Africans at that time, and I knew people from Ghana, and I knew that I'd like to go and work in Ghana. I had met a great friend, actually, up in Cambridge, who became a lawyer. He was a historian and a lawyer. Went back to Ghana, and I was talked a lot with him, and Ghana at the time was the great, the front of changes in Africa, with improvement, the first independent territory, newly independent territory. So Africa attracted me for that reason, and I decided that I would go to Oxford there and work in African studies. And as I say, these grants, I mean, for once, which were going to, which were out of Colonial Development and Welfare Fund, were essentially grants for going to African territories, I mean, mainly African territories. I mean, they weren't sending you to work on peasants in Italy. There wasn't any easy way of getting to work on peasants in Italy at that time. The scholarships were all for work in Africa, which is why all of my contemporaries were working at these different places.
Well, yes, although I think in order to sort of accept the background, I'd like to read something you wrote yourself about yourself at the time. I saw post-war Britain under the Labour government of 45 as the national outcome of many lives like my own. We had grown up between the two wars with an interval of only 20 years from one terrifying destruction to the next, and lived our adolescence under the shadow of continental fascism, and so on. This period began with the Japanese attacks and so on. There followed for my generation some 6.5 years of life under arms, during which time all one could look forward to was post-war reconstruction through the national government and through the United Nations, and this obviously involved the dissolution of earlier empires. Yes. I think it's important for people now who don't recall this and are not in a position to remember the general spirit. For instance, it seems to me worth mentioning that when you decided to go into adult education, you weren't doing just something which Goody thought of. There were several other people, academics.
A large number of other people.
Who were doing this at the same time.
And I should say it was all associated with that APCA during the war, the Army Bureau of Current Affairs, which was very much involved in adult education, which got a lot of people, like Raymond Williams, Thomas Hodgkin, numerous people, working in adult education field. That's absolutely true. And my friend George Fairfield also went into adult education at the same time. A lot of us did.
That's right. I mean,
a lot of us did do that, and it was for, you're absolutely right to point that out, it was for a specific reason at that time. One was, one felt one received an education, and it was, one looked upon education. It was a time, after all, the 1944 Education Act, people going to universities opening up. Made one thought one could do something in the educational field.
And for so many of us, of course, I mean, academic life was not something self-contained, or not just a job. I mean, it was something that we felt had to be, in some ways, useful to the people, both here and abroad. Yes. So that's very
clear. That was absolutely true, and that is why I didn't continue in academic life. I mean, I simply wanted to do something in adult education at that time. And then, of course, as you say, I mean, it was the time when independence was obviously coming. I mean, independence had already come to India. It was obviously going to come to Africa. And one wanted to be part of this kind of process. A lot of people went into, as you know, into adult education in Africa, a great number of my friends. A great number of people who became academics later on went into adult education in Africa, in Nigeria, in Ghana, in East Africa, with various WEA, People's Education Associations, these kind of things that were working in education for. Now, university life did not seem a particular attraction to me at that time. It seemed to me where all these old fuddy-duddies were, and what was happening outside that. One was much more likely to go, as again many of my friends did, to teach in overseas universities at that time, rather than get a job here.
Well, let me take you back to Ghana, where you, so to speak, you arrived there. Now, in a sense, you did your fieldwork there. You paid your dues as an anthropologist. You've kept contact there. You still go out there. Now, what in a sense, did you get out of going to northern Ghana, apart from, as you say, somewhere that this forced you to make contact with French literature?
Yes. Yes.
Well, I got an enormous amount of it, really. I mean, I was forced to sit in a place for 2 years and simply observe what was going on. And you haven't thought very much about the law or religion or things in any concrete way, I mean, except going to church and being head up for riding a bicycle without lights. You know, this was kind of a revelation to me, I think. I mean, just to be involved in all these things, in all these aspects of life, to be involved in... be involved in the whole productive process, too. You know, one living in towns, living in villages in this country, what does one know of the productive processes? I mean, there I learned how to make beer, I learned how to make bread, you know, the equivalent of bread and porridge and so on. I mean, you saw all these things. I mean, everything was there in front of you. I mean, you were free to inquire in all of them. People liked telling you about them. I mean, the whole thing was complete revelation, I think, to me in this way. I don't know that I actually looked at it on that way at the time, but I mean, looking back, I think it was. So it made me interested in a lot of sort of fields of social life, you know, which I wouldn't have thought that I was interested in before. And it made me, those things that I was interested in on an intellectual level, it made me take them up on another one. For example, I mean, I was obviously interested because of my, you know, friendship with Ian Watt and so on, in his work on the Rice the novel, which he was already sort of starting to prepare at the time. And I was interested in, you know, Queenie Leaves' work on fiction and the reading public, and the kind of changes involved with printing and with printing presses and changing the reading public and this general field of sociology of literature. So I was interested in also having looked at medieval literature in sort of oral popular culture, oral culture as against literate culture, and that kind of problem. So it was very interesting to me, and I think I mentioned that in that article you were looking. It was particularly interesting to me because it was on my mind, just as it was on Ian Watt's mind, that because of war, because of being prisoners of war, we weren't always with libraries of the kind that Tim Mumbian built up. I mean, for a number of years we had nothing at all to read. And it was the idea of being in a society, you know, without any reading matter, what this really meant to people inside it, what they could do and what they couldn't do without the book, and without reading and writing, that got me interested in subjects to do with orality and oral and written discourse. Then I was, once again, I got interested in aspects of all the transmission of property out there. I mean, I suppose I've been interested in before for obvious reasons, but I was particularly interested in it out there. So I became a little, I mean, I was more inclined, I suppose, to look at sort of concepts to do with descent and so on in terms of property considerations. But it gave me a chance to look at that, to examine them into adjacent communities, yeah, and to try and point out differences and similarities in those communities.
Supposing I put the question another way, how would your work have changed if, say, instead of going to the Lodaga, is that the way you pronounce it?
Yes, Lodaga, yes.
The Lodaga in northern Ghana, you'd gone to Borneo or to Ceylon? It's a counterfactual question.
It is a counterfactual question. It's one that I haven't It's one that it's a counterfactual question, one that I've never asked myself. I did think of you know, what I would have done in Italy if I'd gone there. I was at that time. Worried about anthropologists going to places like Borneo, Indonesia, let us say Indonesia for a moment, who hadn't got... I was worried about people going, because I was very conscious of the difference between oral and literate societies and so on, but people going to societies that had a written literature and who had a written history, and to my mind, did not seem to know enough about their history. I was rather pleased to go to Africa in a way, because I could read all the documents. I mean, I could do the historical work and the other on this particular area within the compass of my research, and there wasn't a great deal there. And I was always worried about India and China for those reasons, and just say, getting involved in a literate society, which I didn't really know enough about it. I mean, since then, I've, as you know, lost that fear of talking about societies that I don't know enough about. But at that time, I, you know, it was important to me to be in Africa, I thought, because I could know everything there was about a certain area. I mean, about its history, its archaeology, its everything. And that was one of the satisfactions of it there. It was... it perhaps comes out more in French anthropological writings than it does in English ones on Africa, where they've been much more linked up with history. I mean, people like my friend Terre or Claude Dardis, Claude Lemperreau, I mean, and these people, whether they're historians or anthropologists, I mean, you know, I mean, it's irrelevant really. I mean, you don't know. I mean, they're doing the same kind of work. So, I was not very sympathetic, partly because I'd been interested in history, but not very sympathetic to discussions of purely sort of synchronic analysis in anthropology. And I felt I could do that in Africa, whereas I couldn't have done it in Borneo or places where I'd need to learn a lot of classical Arabic languages. I always felt some of my contemporaries, who I were, then who went to work in China or in the Middle East, were always kind of worried because they didn't know the classical languages. And I was already aware while speaking to people in the villages and so on, but they were confined to that area. Where I was much more interested in, I mean, I was interested in that, but particularly when I went on to work in Dodger with Esther Goody, much more interested in the interaction between states and so-called tribal systems in a sort of regional area. And people have done work in that kind. My friend Kathleen Goff did so in India. But it's much more difficult and much more complicated. It involved learning the local languages, learning the classical languages, I think.
So in a sense, it turned out lucky for you,
yes,
for the breadth of your interests.
Yes.
Now, is this, if you like, a retrospective judgment, or did you feel this at the time, that this is a thing which would allow you to take a much broader approach, including historical approach to the thing?
No, I certainly didn't feel that at the time.
Yes.
What I did feel at the time was that... Africa was the most exciting place, I mean, not only politically, but also anthropologically, that is to say, the figures in anthropology that held the senior positions in this country, most of them were Africanists. I mean, Evans Pritchard, before he was Black, and so on. And these were people I knew, and whose work I admired. Not so much from the historical things, they weren't particularly interested in that, their Max was a little. But, you know, theirs was more professional work, and still is in my mind. It's very high professional work. And that was, they were working on Africa rather than other cases.
You've already answered my next question, which really, that obviously you're among the rare anthropologists who insist on working with scholars in other fields, but you have been formed as an anthropologist, and presumably in the UK and in Cambridge. And I was about to ask you, who had influenced you most inside and outside Cambridge or the UK, and whom you admired most?
You mean in the anthropological
field? In the anthropological field. And you've already partly...
I suppose the people I work most closely with have been Evans Pritchard and my Fortis, Stockman. People that I work with on African topics, and the people who were writing at that time, the you know, what were virtually textbooks of textbooks in anthropology, I mean African political systems, African systems of kinship and marriage. These were the these the important, you know, works which were coming out, which were theoretical as well as empirical interest.
Outside the UK, I don't notice any very notable American influence in your at that time.
No. There wasn't any noticeable American influence. There had been a little in getting me interested in anthropology, partly arising out of the war. You know, many of us have read Ruth Benedict, Mead, Jeffrey Gora, and Gregory Bateson. And that was part of the thing that led me to have an interest in anthropology. But there was a lot of hostility over here against that. I suppose one absorbed a good deal of that sort of hostility about references to lady novelists and talk of this kind. There were American influences. I mean, there were American scholars whose work was interesting, but they usually turned out to be people that had worked with Franklin Brown in Chicago, like Egan and Tax, and people of that kind. I can't say that I got a great deal out of a little, perhaps, from reading people like Julian Stewart. Not much from reading Leslie White, I must say. Really didn't find that of great interest. Most of it wasn't sort of professional enough, I think, at the empirical level to warrant the speculations that were built around it.
And the French?
Well, the French, more so. I mean, you see, essentially the training in England at that time was largely Durkheimian. Essentially because of Franklin Brown, Evans Pritchard, and company. And so that from, you know, I mean, I read an enormous amount of Durkheim. And I was reading the work of the Annie Sociologique down to today, and you know, a number of my contemporaries there were doing the translations of Durkheim into English. Rodney Needham, Ian Cunnison in the volume of The Gift and so on. I mean, all these have been translated by pupils of Evans Pritchard and Fortis, Evans Pritchard. Read. So that a lot of that was a lot of that was in the hour. But French anthropology was not of supreme interest at that time, apart from the new work of Levi-Strauss. Partly because it centered around these sort of field trips of Griot and company to West Africa, which many of us were rather suspicious of what was coming out of these. There were people who didn't speak the language.
Mm.
There were people who went to field sites for short periods of time and were prepared to talk about myth and complexities of religion and ideology without understanding the language of the people themselves, and that seemed to many of us to be a supreme insult. It's already well talking about material objects and household censuses and things like that, but to choose things like myth, you know, when you don't know how to speak the language, and this so many of them are doing. And the work was very speculative. It turns out to be very speculative. I mean, they thought they were doing a terrible work. And I think it has not stood the test of time, really, much of it. But Levi-Strauss's work was coming up. And that was interesting. That was much more interesting on the, obviously, on an intellectual level.
Not unspeculative.
Again, the fieldwork element, as many have pointed out, particularly English anthropologists, was somewhat limited. And once again, was highly speculative. But he was using ideas in a more interesting way than than others. I mean, French anthropology has changed a lot since then, in the 60s and 70s, and partly because of the enormous amount of funds which the French are prepared to put into things like this, has done very well. I mean, now extremely good ethnographic work is done in France, probably better than anywhere else.
You weren't put off by the rather anti-historical approach of the classical British functionalists, which seemed to me only to be just about fraying at the edges in the early and middle 50s.
It was fraying at the edges then, but curiously, it didn't really exist for very long. I mean, it was, you know, when you think of it, it was Malinowski, of course, principally.
Radcliffe Brown?
And Radcliffe Brown in a more theoretical way, that is absolutely true. Yes. And of course, it was following, you know, a long, you know, sociological tradition of separating off diachronic from synchronic studies. It was fraying at the edges then. I mean, you know, Evans Pritchard was had done his work on the on Cyrenaica. Shapiro was clearly interested in historical matters. Max Gleichmann was, though sometimes in a rather cryptographic fashion, I think, with Max. I mean, he was, but I mean, he sometimes shifted his point of view of that. No, I mean, it just seemed natural to me. I mean, you know, more or less the first paper I wrote, I think, in Ghana was on, you know, it was on the influence of Islam, the background influence of Islam coming in there. It just seemed to be natural to write about those kind of things. So it didn't really worry me what other people were saying about this. I mean, I could see that there was a case to be made for doing a synchronic study for certain points of view. I mean, from certain points of view. But to think that it answered all the questions, or think that one could say that, you know, history was irrelevant or history was bunk, I mean, that seemed to me to be not worth the case, but not worth arguing.
No, indeed. Now, these are the people you admired,
yes,
and influenced you. Who were or are you against? Anthropologically,
yes,
in your field. Schools, people.
Yes, well, I suppose one with I I mean, I suppose earlier on I was against most people there, the sort of school of British anthropology was against. I mean, there was a time when the school of British anthropology in the early 50s was a pretty sort of close, as you know, close sort of network at the time, the association of the founding association of social anthropologists and so on. When they certainly thought they had certain keys for unlocking the secrets of the universe. So, you know, one tended to look down on people trained in America, for example. In fact, even now, I think this Association of Social Anthropologists, it did broaden out to the Commonwealth, and it includes, I don't know whether this is true to this day, but I think it is, it includes people on the basis of where they were trained. At first it was only in England, then it was extended to the Commonwealth, it's never been extended to America. And Americans can join if they spend time over here. But otherwise, it's a rather exclusive club. So I suppose it wasn't true that I was against some of the kind of psychological anthropology that was taking place in the States. I was against, I think, some of the culture and personality work, because that seemed to be rather superficial. But not against, not against others. I suppose people would say that I was might stigmatize me as an anti-structuralist. I'm not sure that I would accept altogether that designation. I always find the works of Levi-Strauss an interesting polemical reference point, let me put it that way. I mean, worth arguing about.
Just one incidental question.
Yes.
Paul Arnie, any opinions? He has been influential in anthropology.
Yes, he has been influential in anthropology, and I did read him a lot. He had a great influence, of course, on my close friend and neighbour, Moses Fender. And many others. And I, during the 50s, I was influenced by Paul Arnie, yes, and I think many of us were. But I became, for intellectual reasons, I became unhappy about the kinds of radical divisions that he was making. The way he was making radical divisions against such, I mean, I wasn't happy about the concept of the ancient economy, for example. I mean, I wasn't very happy about the concept of the ancient economy in the way that Moses expounded it. I wasn't really happy about the specifying the level of society in which reciprocity was and similar mechanisms were the only mechanisms of exchange. You know, the more I looked at Africa and the history of Africa and I think this came out of the work of a number of historians of Africa, like Basil Davidson and others, that you know, commercial exchange was a part of the African way of life for very many years. And I thought that the attempts to apply Polanyi theory to Dahomey, for example, were pretty, were not really very, very useful at all. I'm the kind of porter. There was something in that sort of porter trade notion, but it was not, I think he overgeneralized the notion. And it meant that people were not giving enough attention, I thought, to the long, to commercial exchanges in you know, in Africa. I mean, they accepted situations in which, as a society I went to, in which people were using extraordinary numbers of kauris. And they analysed the situation in those terms. But when you ask where these enormous amount of kauris came from, I mean, they all came from Maldives Islands off the Indian Ocean. They came in some kind of exchange system, which was not reciprocal, I mean, which was a commercial exchange system. And that was part of the, that was part of the operational system, as I saw it, not simply the little local business of exchanging kauris up and down for chickens and goats and so on. It tied in with that. I mean, just as, I mean, I was always impressed with the whole role, I mean, including areas adjacent to me in Africa, that they played in the medieval gold trade and pushing medieval gold into Italy to enter into commercial exchanges with the West. It was that kind of networking that I was interested in, and it seemed to be the kind of sort of cuttings off that Polanyi did and the people accepted at that time made it more difficult to understand and even to describe these kinds of things.
Ah. Now, let's get a little bit further into your work. In your, so to speak, autobiographical statement in the Annual Review of Anthropology, it describes the key words, probably this isn't your choice, or is it? As history, Cambridge, kinship, literacy, Lodaga.
No, I did. That was not, I hope, my. I hope that was not my choice. I don't think, as I recall, that I made. I made any choice in that way.
What else would you put in, and what?
I certainly would have put in comparative studies in some way or other. I mean, now when I went to Lodegaard, I was interested, as I say, in inheritance systems. It was partly because I'd read a little about these in Europe before, and I was interested in how they differed and were similar to European arrangements. And I wasn't in Africa simply to look at African societies. I mean, I was interested in comparing these with European ones that I've lived in and Asian ones that I've worked in, that I had read about. So, and very often the things I write sort of start off with Africa, but they spread in a sometimes rather picaresque way into other areas. Because I'm interested in trying to make sense of it, make sense of this in a wider context. Make sense of what I've read about and what I've experienced in Africa. So I think that I would add, for what it's worth, comparative studies to that, since it seems to me that's part of what I'm interested in doing.
Right. Now, the point is, it seems to me that it's not only comparative studies, but in some ways a very broad, what Perry Anderson calls a deliberately macro-evolutionary tack. As it were, what happened in history, to go back to Gordon Child.
Well, it's quite true that Gordon Child is really one of the important books I've read, yes.
I have that impression.
What happened in history? You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. What happened in history was one of the really important books for me. Yes. I mean, yes, I was interested in what happened from the Bronze Age on, that's true, and how that's quite critical. And it was critical to me because it seemed to me that in Africa, talking to economists and talking to many other people, particularly I'm trying to understand the processes of development that were taking place in Africa or were not taking place in Africa, then it came to be absolutely clear to me, and this was an important revelation out of Africa for me, it came up in the Nkrumah era, I remember, in a rather acute form. when I gave some lectures, public lectures, suggesting that African agriculture could be improved by the adoption of the plough. This was much against the policy of Nkrumah at the time, who was intent on importing Yugoslav tractors, which rarely worked and cost a great deal. And it was the it was a notion of people working on at that time, and still are to a large extent, that there was a kind of third world which was all a sort of one level like that, in which one could do certain things to improve and to bring it up to, you know, standards of Western Europe and America in a relatively short space of time. And it just seemed to me that there were such enormous differences between Africa and the cultures, you know, that China was talking about in the Bronze Age, because they were not based on, you know, on the use of the written word, they were not based on the plough, they didn't have numerous specialisms and technologies and so on, which they needed to develop. And people thought they could bring in a tractor or a plough without any knowledge, I mean simply as an instrument, without any idea that this had a whole social organisation of production behind it. And that it could, you know, that they could change things overnight. I mean, the one thing we've learned about Africa is that we can't change things overnight. It isn't simply a question of putting down some kind of, making some kind of technological change at that level, without seeing that technology within a much wider social system of social organization, of production, as I say, that way.
Yes. It seems to me you're once again anticipating the question I was about to ask, which is not at all. It seems to me that the axis around which a lot of your work turns, at least over things, is precisely that of the contrast between Africa and the Eurasian society.
That's right.
And I mean, it comes out in practically all writing. It seems to me to structure in many ways.
Yes, yes.
Let me incidentally ask one incidental question.
Yes.
Why don't you ever bring in the Americas and American societies?
Well, I know I should do, but I'm already stretching myself as much as I can go. I do have American societies. I am interested in them. I know a little about them. And it's just that it would require a lot more work, and I don't know quite. It obviously adds something, and no doubt modify any ideas that I had. But it's not either through sort of deliberate neglect. I mean, I am conscious of it. It's just that, but I suppose with regard to, I mean, Africa and Europe is obvious. What I want to do, I mean, what I'm interested in doing with Europe and Asia, in a sense, which I'm working on my latest day, is connected with the opposition to Africa, and then is to see those as much more similar than many scholars have wanted to do. So I once wanted to emphasize the differences I see it between Africa and India, and then make the difference less between India and China and Europe. I mean, it's always seemed to me that Levi Strauss's exemplification of China and parts of India and so on as elementary structures of kinship there must be something ultimately profoundly wrong about comparing those, except on a very limited level, with Australian systems.
Mm.
If you were doing so, then you were saying something very restrictive about the notion of kinship in those contexts. You were singling out something which clearly was not linked to, entailed in any very close way with the society as a whole. And it was their area. I wanted to see what aspects of kinship and so on were linked to the society as a whole. And I saw these as nearer to European systems than African ones.
Well, you've obviously done this in an extremely stimulating manner, not to mention the differences between Europe and some of the others. Nevertheless, what I want to ask is this. Yeah. Essentially, this major axis of your work, the contrast between Africa and Asia, in the broadest sense, seems to me a sort of materialist conception of history approach. You see, after all, in the one hand, you have got a certain type of agriculture and various other things which follow from it. In the other, you have limited resources and so on and so on. In some ways, it ties in with Gordon Child because of the agriculture, plough, literacy and so on coming in. Now, how did you get to this, and how early would you say that you really began to formulate this basic organizing principle of what is still coming out of your work, and why?
Yes. Well, obviously, I see it as related to the kind of thing that you're asking me. But, I mean, no simple way, because I'm also interested in meeting. I also see Bronze Age civilizations as, you know, as introducing literacy and the books we have around us and the forms of knowledge in which we're dealing with. And I see these as being absent from Africa, or except in areas where Islam entered and brought with it some of these aspects of Mediterranean culture. But it wasn't available, by and large, for organizing state systems and for doing a whole lot of other things, intellectual as well as others. So it's also on that level. Yes, I think it's absolutely true to say that I do see literacy. I do see literacy. I see writing as emergent at a certain point in the development of human society. To the extent, coming back to the point of schools that I would differ with, the relativistic tendency in anthropology, which I appreciate in certain areas, like perhaps the relativity of morals or something like that, to push that to those kind of areas and not be prepared to talk about the differences between, and the important differences I see between societies with writing and without writing, or societies with systems of production that can support a literati and that can support various specialists like ourselves who are not engaged in primary production processes. I mean, that's just critical, yes. I think that would be critical to my thinking. I mean, that obviously links up with earlier things that I read of Marx and Engels. It also comes out of my experience in Africa, where I ask myself very much, what in this community? In the first place, I ask myself in this community, how could one support a school population, that kind of thing? I didn't ask it soon enough, without changes in the economic structure,
that's right,
which would have enabled us to do this. So what happened in that fascinating period, and I wish I would spend my time writing the history of this in a general way, after the liberation of these countries was that we put in all these universities and so on, which we thought were going to change things overnight, without asking how these were going to be supported. I mean, I'm afraid we simply didn't ask the question we should have done, given our background perhaps. We did not ask the economic questions about these, but we thought they would follow. And I mean, the one thing that's so tragic about the place now is that, you know, these institutions were built up and have now had to retract. Bureaucracies were built up, and one of the fascinating things that is going on now is that is to find them the new adaptations to the possible situations in which you find school teachers and university teachers being part-time farmers, you know, farming and doing their farming work. And this is the adaptation to a situation which I suppose, you know, the flux of interest of, you know, wanting Africa to develop and change after war. We'd hoped they would get over this phase. But they haven't yet. And it strikes me the more one looks at developments in Africa today and compares that with the kind of development that's taken place in Taiwan, Hong Kong, Korea, and these kind of places, you know, where are the African African Koreas? I mean, where are the African Taiwans and so on? It isn't because people haven't tried. I mean, there's been a lot of attempt. I mean, a lot of attention was given to Africa at that, you know, at that time. But what we were building on at the economic level and at the level of literacy, though I must say we've had a lot more success in education than we have in other things. A lot more success, very interesting. I mean, that has been one great success, really. I mean, unfortunately, because we've educated people who are now thriving in America and elsewhere. I was in Chicago recently. I was told 8,000 Ghanaians in Chicago all these, the educated people. I mean, the country can't afford that sort of thing. And there's nothing now going on. I mean, what you see now in Ghana is really no different than I would, you know, than economic, or very little different than it was at the time of the time of independence.
Well, of course, that raises issues which don't distinguish only Africa from the remainder of the world, but almost every relatively poor country, underdeveloped country. I mean, this drain of the educated people towards the first world.
Terrible.
However, the point, it seems to me, that you do bring out very much is that as against the sort of fashion for pure relativism,
yes,
you insist and you take the view that, yes, one must insist on the, yes, difference between simple and complex, primitive, yes, and further advanced societies, whether you put them in inverted commas or not.
I mean, I insist upon a range a range of complexity in that way, which seems to be absolutely critical for understanding what is happening now and what has happened in the past. Yeah, I do see that. Yeah.
Yes, I mean, I would agree with you. And of course, the thing that follows from it is obviously that it is exceedingly difficult to jump, so to speak, if you're used to one kind of your society structured in one way with a certain background. Simply to transform this from one day to the next, it won't work.
It's enormously difficult. I look in my rural area in Africa today, where they've got the wheel, but all the wheels are made outside. I mean, nobody knows. I mean, every wheel, in every Indian village, you've got a wheel right there, like you had out in East Anglia. He makes wheels. They know now the principle of the wheel, but they don't make the wheel, so they depend on every bicycle. As far as I'm aware in Africa, maybe Nigeria's changed. Every wheel on anything has got to come in from outside. There are no little horses or bullocks or something or anything, or donkeys or anything, pulling anything. I mean, so that you are completely dependent this way. And I mean, that is something that I read about in the answer. But I mean, it strikes me every time I go back there how critically important this is, that the dependence of the country on our side, I mean, if they don't have these imports, if they don't have this aid from the World Bank, they go back to headloading. I mean, literally. Because there's no change in the social organization of production which produces cars. It is true, people have tried, and people have. There's a little of it in some of the French churches where people have tried to set these things up, but they're not at the village level yet. I mean, there's still, you know, aid volunteers coming in to do this, and. I mean, the more I look at that, the more I ask myself, how the hell, you know, did other societies adopt this? It must have been a great traumatic process to do, you know, for the adaptation of things like this. And to shift from, you know, one form of transport which you were set up to deal with at the village, you know, to another one. You only have people coming in and living, prepared to live at the village level, who are going to knock out your wheels and start up a smithy, you know, for dealing with this kind of thing. And we're still a long way, long, long way from that, long, long way from that in Africa.
Now, out of your sort of basic approach, you've developed, shall we say, three strands of your writings. One is the whole business about family, marriage, and, if you like, reproduction.
Yes.
You know, so.
Yes.
The other is the one arising out of your oral and literacy studies.
Yes.
And the third, if I read you rightly, is the one that you concentrated on to some extent in the 80s, which you might call cultural, if food culture and flower culture is part of the thing.
Yes.
Now, incidentally, are there any other aspects that you think here that you would like to pursue but haven't had a chance to?
Well, I was very much interested in not only means of mass production and mass communication, but also what I called modes of destruction.
That's right. I noticed this has taken a bit more of a back seat than your
Yes, it does, actually. Although, one time it was... I mean, I was particularly important in Africa to me. But, I mean, once again, this is actually critical to my thinking about Africa. When the Portuguese came round, came around to West Africa and established their forces. I mean, they did so with the aid of cannon and handguns. And even at the early stage, there were some Portuguese who rushed off and sold handguns to the to local people, to Africans, and got a good price for them. And then, of course, when the English and the Dutch broke away from the Catholic bans on selling firearms to Africans, to the infidel, they moved in and sold a great deal of dead guns, as it's now called to this day, down in West Africa. But the Africans could never make them. They could only ever make their guns. They can copy things, they can copy even some of the intricate men, the firing mechanism and so on. But it was absolutely critical to every African state was to have an outside supply of guns. Because although they had ironworking, which did come across Africa, they never had furnaces that would make steel. I mean, they could never make barrels. And I mean, I've been in places at funerals, there were some where they've been shooting off firearms at a funeral. And, you know, these barrels have just burst open because somebody's put a bicycle fuel instead of a gun barrel on the end of a rifle. They never knew how to do this. And yet, Drake and Portuguese got to Arabia, to the Malabar coast, to Japan. People had the levels of iron technology there to be able to copy the European guns, so that you were getting Malabari guns and so on, straight away, and making very important changes to politics and so on in Japan and in India. But Africa was always dependent on the import of guns, is to this day, as far as I'm aware. And once again, I mean, this sort of dependence, because they had not developed a certain level of production and found it difficult, just not because they're unintelligent or anything like that, but you mean, these are difficult things to do. I didn't invent the bicycle. I mean, I simply accepted technology which was set up here. But this never, you know, it was never institutionalized, it was never built up in Africa. It was very critical. It meant that all firearms had to come from outside.
The other thing that strikes me that you have, shall we say, got a bit less interested in recently is the whole question of state and state power, which at one time was
used. Yes.
And the other thing that I'm not certain that you've ever dealt very widely with in your comparative work is cities.
No, I never have done. That's absolutely right there. Well, I did actually give some lectures once on cities in Africa. That is a long bit stuff. And I was interested in the nature of cities in Africa, and the Anglo city and so on, and the merchant city. But I never went into any systematic comparison, nor did I with state power. I mean, I have, in a certain way, with state, with some aspects of state systems, but it's really been more to do, you mentioned the cultural interest, it's more to do with the nature of difference in class, in inverted commas, in the strata, in the relationships between strata. And the differences, for example, I mean, the area that Esther and I worked in, or she mainly worked in, can't tell you. I've written about this, and I was immensely impressed with the fact that the people were marrying everywhere. I mean, the ruling class were marrying commoners and so on. And it wasn't at all like the sort of Indian situation, or even the situation that Mark Bloch writes about for England, with people marrying in a circle, you know, intending to marry in their circle. In fact, there were tendencies to marry outside. Rulers would marry commoners, partly because they were maybe beautiful, partly because they wanted ties with commoner groups. There was no incentive, there was no cultural cuttings off in that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were certain differences between the high and low, but there was no cultural cuttings off in that way. The boundaries were much looser. That aspect of state systems that I've been interested in. I've thought about the others, Eric, but it's really that I've never thought of any conceptual way of any way of burying, for example, the different complexities of state systems that weren't sort of very obvious ones. And I think one can talk in terms of authority and so on and so forth, but it's very difficult to do comparative work in that field, I've always found. Maybe I should read Michael Mann's book, which I haven't, about power. I've never felt anything very satisfactory. When I've tried to compare this in African societies, rather simply, I've never really got very far in doing so. Never felt I've been able to handle it very well.
What I'm really trying to get at is something else.
Yes.
You're obviously, if you like, you know, a sort of totalizing historical anthropologist. I mean, a sort of, you try to cover everything, all bases. Nevertheless, in fact, you find yourself in your actual work concentrating on certain strands much more than others.
Absolutely.
Now, is this in some ways, because, in a sense, why is it that you have found yourself concentrating on these strands rather than on some other.
Yes.
It's not supposing that you're not interested in.
Well, I mean, they're partly sort of just, you know, reasons of one's own personal biography. I mean, the literacy thing is pretty obvious because I worked with Ian on it, and I, you know, I got interested in that because I was interested in English and so on. Stuff to do with family, I suppose, came out of the general sort of, you know, this is one thing that anthropologists specialize in, and one was interested in that. And the third element, which was the third element, you were, there are certain areas, yes, that I haven't touched upon, and I mean, not with any sort of deliberate thing. I mean, I've sort of touched upon what interested me at a particular time. Not, I think, because I thought any of them were more particularly, you know, important than another. It isn't that I don't think that state power is not important, but that I haven't really seen my way of dealing with it.
Well, yes, that's fine. Now, let me just say, I don't think we want to carry on for forever.
We certainly don't. We have a cup final, see.
No, what I want to ask you is really this. Where do you think your interests are likely to lead you next? Assuming you're in a position to carry on.
Yes, assuming I'm in a position to carry on. Well, I'm really interested, I think, in... I think what I'd probably be interested in when I finish my flower book, I mean, I have one or two other things to deal with, but is that... I really probably want to try and sum up, for my own satisfaction, some of the kinds of similarities and differences that I see them between European and Asian societies, partly at the level of culture and knowledge systems generally. Trying to distill something out of, you know, Needham's work, Joseph Needham's work, and other things. And this touches on what I'm interested in flowers as well as food. Partly looking at aspects of the family, as I've done in that book, partly looking at some other variables, for example, accounting systems. Some of these things that people have thought made a great difference between European and Asian societies and in their development. It's partly sort of rethinking Weber and the concept of Oriental society. And looking at various aspects of this kind of a contrast, particularly at the period, say 1700, 1800, looking at. Trying to have knowledge systems at that time in terms of botanical knowledge and things of this kind. Across these areas. Part of it is a theory at the and now that we've got these societies developing so rapidly, and I mean, it again goes back to the African problem, partly because we've got these societies developing
into capitalist systems so rapidly in the East, some societies, that I don't see this as a matter of pure imitation. I see it as a matter of certain, building on certain aspects of what was there before.
Right.
Which I don't see as happening in Africa. It's really partly trying to account for that kind of a thing, for in terms of contributions to knowledge and so forth.
Right, let me just ask right at the end an almost impossible question.
Yes.
Supposing somebody comes to you and says, okay, what have you actually contributed to anthropology? What would you say?
Well, I've contributed at one level that we haven't really discussed, and that's my fieldwork level, and something that I've done since I feel proud about, and that is recording an unrecorded myth and editing that and publishing various versions. I mean, and having done that at a time when the tape recorder came in, and I was able to, I think, to, for me anyhow, change my views on mythology at the time. And at that level, you know, I feel I've done something, and one is pleased to be called back to Africa, as we were at December, in order to discuss these matters with locals from the area now. And so it's nice to have done that at the local ethnographic level. And I'm not sure if I haven't had my time again, I wouldn't have spent more time doing that at the level at the local ethnographic level, because of the satisfaction that it brings on. With regard to the other, I hope that I would have made historical facts relevant. Pointed out the relevance for many problems, not all, of historical facts for and notions for anthropological processes, and for the comparison of societies now and in the past, and that one can't lightly overthrow the history of Africa just like that in the course of development. One has to take into account this and build on what is there. But other than that, well, I think I have, in my mind, made, to me, a little sense of the distribution of some historical and sociological data. I mean, they may not be entirely correct, I'm sure it could be modified in many ways, but trying to relate things like the existence of adoption and matters of that at the level of kinship with various, with wider social systems in this kind of regional way,